Padmavajra brought this in the Dharma. As Padmavajra has just mentioned, I've recently been on a year's sabbatical. And my one main sort of venture out from Gokuloka was to attend and to lead part of the Tuscany reunion retreat that we held at Il Convento in May, June last year. Now, Il Convento is for me a very special place. It's always been quite an archetypal place. I spent 18 months living there on retreat in the 1980s, and during that time I saw 101 men ordained. And it's also where Bhante gave his papers on the journey to Il Convento and St. Jerome Revisited. So, coming back to Il Convento after 15 years, something in me sort of saw the retreat in quite archetypal terms. But what surprised me a little bit was that I didn't see it in particularly Buddhist archetypal terms. Much of the time I experienced it in terms of the Arthurian legends, which most of you, I suspect, will know something of the Arthurian legends. King Arthur is a semi-historical figure in ancient Britain who became the subject of a whole literature from about the 12th to the 14th century in Western Europe, in which the tale of King Arthur is gradually developed. So he, in the tale as it becomes more developed, he gathers around him a fellowship of knights who are the knights of the Round Table. And one of their main, one of the central aspects of the story is the quest for the Holy Grail. Now, the Grail, in different versions of the story, is different things. But it's always associated with Jesus Christ and the Last Supper. And in some versions, it's a dish or a platter. In some versions of the tale, it's a stone. And in some, it's a chalice or a goblet. But always, it represents having a vision of the Grail. Represents, well, the sort of highest vision, almost, that these knights within this Christian context can have. This Grail, which is supposed to have been brought back to Britain by Joseph of Arimathea. So, during those weeks last summer, Il Convento became, in my mind, not an old monastery, but a kind of Camelot, which was King Arthur's court. It was a Dharma castle, from which, over a six-year period, 101 men had ridden forth on the quest of the Holy Grail of enlightenment. And now, 15 to 20 years later, we were reassembling from all points of the compass. I'd actually brought with me back to Il Convento a lot of photos from those retreats from 81 to 86, with a lot of, well, they seemed absurdly sort of fresh-faced, sort of young knights who were going to ride out, full of enthusiasm for the quest. So now we were all returning to Camelot, older and wiser. Although some, while still continuing on the quest, were unable to join us, and a few, a handful, had left the chivalric order of knights, and if they were still questing, were doing it in their own way, in their own fashion, no longer in contact with the rest of us. So I looked around me at the assembled company. So I say, a lot more grey hair than there'd been before. And we'd all been on the quest for 15 years or more. And we all had tales to tell, adventures to recount. Some of us had quite enjoyed the quest. Perhaps, who knows, a few might even have had some glimpses of the Grail. But there were also those who had fought dragons and been badly singed. Some who'd been imprisoned by evil wizards or enchantresses. And there were those who'd had periods of just being separated from their brother knights and had wandered long in barren landscapes. And the king himself had aged. He was now 75, and his external sight was failing him. Though it was clear from the equanimity with which he dealt with that event that his inner vision was still bright, perhaps brighter than ever, and his certainty that it was possible for each of us to succeed on the Grail quest was as strong as when he'd witnessed our setting out all those years ago. Now, I spent some time during my year's sabbatical at Gukyaloka reflecting on, well, on all sorts of things, but amongst them on this experience that I had at Il Convento, thinking about the ups and downs and struggles that people had gone through. And when at times I began to forget that train of thought, it would often be restarted by reading Shabda. In each month's crop of reportings in, there were always a certain number of order members who were going through it. Men or women in crisis, not sure why they're practicing the Dharma, unsure about the order or the FWBO, depressed, etc., etc., etc. So my experience at Il Convento / Camelot and my reading of Shabda prompted me to want to give a talk about spiritual crisis and difficulty. Now, I'm sorry if this isn't a very inspiring topic, though personally I often find order members' struggles very inspiring, because people do struggle, they don't just give up. And so I'm going to look at some spiritual struggles, some crucial situations. And I'll be drawing on my observations of the order over these almost 28 years. And I'll also be drawing on my own rich and varied experience of spiritual crises, doubts, difficulties and downfalls. And if you find some of this helpful to you, all well and good. But before I do talk more specifically, I want first to say something about maps. The first part of my title, Here Be Dragons, comes from inscriptions which you'd often find written on old sort of medieval maps, yeah? Either to cover sort of places where people hadn't been, or places where people had been and come back and said, "Oh, you don't want to go there, there's dragons there." So, yes, inscriptions on old maps from the days long before just about every square metre of our planet had been surveyed, explored, or at least photographed from the air. And I want to start by talking about maps, because accurate maps of the spiritual terrain are crucial for the spiritual quest. Obviously, we need to know the direction in which enlightenment lies, otherwise we could search forever. Now, in a sense, we have no problems in this regard at all. The Buddha's laid out very clearly the nature of enlightenment and the general path of ethics, meditation, and wisdom that leads to it. However, to be confident on the journey, we also need as clear as possible a map of the terrain over which we're actually likely to pass. And it seems to me that here, as Westerners, practicing the Dharma, we need to start doing some new map making. All too often we're working with traditional maps, descriptions of the path that may not quite fit our experience. We have some very beautiful maps, such as, say, the spiral path, in which independence upon suffering arises faith, independence upon faith arises joy, independence upon that rapture, and so on, up and up, to knowledge and vision and beyond. That's a map, if you like, of the path. There's also the Buddha's account in the Samanyapala Sutta of the fruits of the life of a recluse. He describes how one who's gone forth into the homeless life practices the precepts. This gives him a basis for the practice of contemplation. That enables him to guard the doors of the senses. That enables him to develop sati and sampajanya. That leads to contentment, overcoming the five hindrances, and then cultivating the jhanas. That gives birth to insight, and the development of supernormal powers, and so on, until one arrives at liberation of heart and the certainty that enlightenment has been gained. That's a very beautiful map. Now, it's not that there's anything the matter with these maps, they're true in a sense. But I don't think that any of the people sort of who came back to Il Convento would have described their spiritual path over those 15 or 20 years quite in those terms. In a way, the maps are too idealized to meet our needs as we strive to follow them. They can tend to give us a rather rosy picture of the spiritual life. They're a bit like aerial photos of the terrain to be covered, which are taken from too high up to show the peat bogs, the rocks, and so on that a walker will actually encounter. At least a Western walker, at least a modern Western walker. And then it's easy for us to compare our own spiritual life to these ideal accounts and become disheartened and feel that we're completely useless Buddhist practitioners. Now, it's clear from reading the Buddhist literature that even some of the greatest Buddhist practitioners actually didn't find the spiritual life so straightforward. In the Pali Canon, you read many accounts of monks who become disheartened or dissatisfied with the Dharma life, who lose their inspiration. In the Mahayana tradition, you have people like Asanga, who's meditating intensively and every few years completely gives up, but then sort of goes back and carries on. Or in the Tantric tradition, you have Virupa, who becomes finally a great siddha, who's very important for the Sakya school of Tibetan Buddhism. But at a certain stage, after years of meditating on a certain yidam, he gets so disheartened that he's had absolutely no results at all, that he takes his mala and he throws it into a cesspit. So I don't find quite that in the spiral path or in the account in the Sambhanyapala Sutta. And of course there are cases of burnout, such as Hakuin, who in his Yasin Kana describes how he pushed himself so hard that for a while at least he became a mental and physical wreck. In the Pali Canon too, the Buddha also gives descriptions of the spiritual life that make it sound a little less straightforward than the account in the Samanyapala Sutta. For example, there's a sutta, I think it's in the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha says that for some people, the spiritual life is easy to start with and easy later on. For other people, it's easy to start with and difficult later on. For some people, it's difficult to start with and easy later on. And yes, for some people it's difficult to start with and difficult later on. Until, of course, you reach the end when all those difficulties are seen to be completely worthwhile. So even if we manage to put together realistic maps from traditional sources, we're still faced with the fact that as an early generation of Dharma practitioners in the West, although the general principles of the Dharma will be the same, some of the doubts and difficulties and some of the psychological mechanisms involved in practicing those general principles will be different. Maybe in 500 years' time, Western Buddhist teachers will be able to guide their students along well-plotted routes, well aware of the likely pitfalls and difficulties. But we have to pioneer, with all the risks that pioneering involves, venturing into unexplored territory. We have to run the risk of the spiritual equivalent of falling into a crevasse or being eaten by bears. To take one example of what I'm talking about, if you follow the traditional maps, getting into dhyana is followed by, well, more dhyana, and then by the development of insight. However, last year at Grihyaloka, I had a very interesting conversation with Bodhananda, who's led a lot of meditation retreats at Vajraloka and elsewhere, and during those retreats has conducted many meditation interviews. And he said that in his experience, it was almost inevitably the case that someone came on retreat, would get themselves into dhyana, and two or three days later would fall into a sort of pit. They'd fall out of that dhyana, often into quite a sort of dark state. And I must say that was also my experience in my first years of practice. It was as if I sort of managed to integrate, well, sort of like the tip of the iceberg of consciousness. I was only aware of the the little tip of my experience. And I managed to get that all nice and harmonized and integrated. So I experienced some dhyana. But then, that integration had the effect of drawing up more energy, more material, as it were, into consciousness. And that was a step forward. But the effect of that drawing up was that it broke up that previous harmony. It precipitated me out of dhyana, and sometimes into some quite dark realms, at least for a little while. Even these days, I often find that a day of dhyanic meditation, when I have such a thing, is often followed by a night of shadow dreams, full of dark forces and sort of primitive sort of swamp creatures wandering around. So we need to be prepared to modify our maps of the spiritual life in the light of experience. Yes, there may come a point at which, if you really are integrated on a deep level and really well established in dhyana, then from there is just more dhyana and insight. But we also need to understand that earlier dhyanic experiences may be followed by quite uncomfortable experiences. And if our map includes such things, then we'll be prepared for them. And we won't give ourselves a hard time or regard ourselves as spiritual failures when we experience them, telling ourselves this isn't supposed to happen, which is always a singularly useless thought. So when I first planned this talk, I thought I'd share with you some of the varied sort of crises and difficulties that I've gone through over the years, in the hope that my experience would help your own map making for your spiritual quest. However, I soon realized that there wasn't going to be anything like time to describe all the various crises and difficulties I've gone through. It would need to be, you know, at least a sort of 8-talk series like one of Bante's. So in the end, I decided that I'd just pick out a few crucial situations that I've observed order members getting into in their spiritual quests over the years, and of which I have a bit of a degree of experience myself. So I'm just going to pick 3 out of the ocean of possible difficulty. And I'm not going to, I decided I won't talk particularly personally. I'd like us to sort of all get a little bit of perspective about this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about the Grail Quest. I'm going to describe these difficulties and crucial situations in terms of a knight in search of the Holy Grail and what he might experience. And just possibly, we shall find that it has some similarities to something that some of us may have gone through or may even be going through right now. So let's start. Let's take the first crucial situation. Let's take the case of, he's quite a young knight. He's not been dubbed a knight for very long. He spent quite a few years as a squire, sort of training and preparing, always looking towards the day when he'd finally join the Order of Knights and would be permitted to embark on the Grail Quest. In fact, in a way, he's been rather carried along into becoming a knight. He's surrounded by lots of friends who've all had the same dreams. But now, as he rides out on the quest for the first time, he finds himself, somehow or other, alone in a dark wood. And the wood seems to go on forever. And he's not got much food with him, he's quite hungry, and the rain beats down, flattening the plume on his helmet. And at a certain point, some way off, through the trees, he sees the unmistakable outline of a dragon. It's moving away from him. And for better or worse, there's too much undergrowth between him and the dragon for him to ride after it and challenge it. Now it has to be said that our young knight isn't entirely sorry about this. Because although he's very keen to make his name as a knight, he can't help noticing that the dragon is even bigger than he'd imagined dragons to be when he used to sit with the other squires at Camelot, listening wide-eyed to the old knight's tales. So there he is in this wood, having seen the dragon. And at this point, the young knight shocks himself. From out of nowhere, he finds himself wondering something. He finds himself wondering if the Grail exists. He's always more or less taken its existence for granted. And he's been so caught up with the excitement of preparing to become a knight that he hadn't really ever thought the issue through very deeply for himself. And of course he's had the example of the king and the other knights, the stars of the chivalric world, who have claimed to have had visions of the Grail. But somehow, alone by himself in this dripping wood, their testimony no longer seems so compelling. It seems rather distant to him. The security that he gained from them seems very far away. So he dismounts, and he sits under an oak tree, and he begins to think for himself. What is he doing out here? And what does he really know about the Grail? And who is he anyway? So that's our first crucial situation. It is, we might say, a crisis of belief. In practicing the Dharma, we inevitably take a lot on trust. Our views are a mixture. There are a few things that we know directly from our own experience of life. Then there are some that we don't know to be true directly, but in which we believe, either logically or intuitively, they make sense to us. And then there are aspects of the Dharma, of the Order, of the FWBO, and of course the three aren't entirely synonymous, of which we're not convinced, but which we either take on trust or provisionally accept on a, well, let's try this out basis. And it's important that we know, that we keep track of which of these three categories our different views fall into. Often, we're not clear. And with me, I used to find in my earlier days as an order member that from time to time, everything that I'd taken on trust, everything that I didn't really know for myself, would sort of fall over. And I'd be forced to come back to what I fundamentally believed for myself, without any intellectual or emotional support from the FWBO or anyone else. And the first time this happened, as my card house of views lay scattered around me, I was really left with only two cards left standing, so like two foundation stones. I knew that I believed in awareness. However painful it might be, however difficult it was, I believed that awareness was always a good thing. And secondly, I believed in love. And I didn't want to call it metta at that point. But then, after a while, so say everything else having dissolved away, having come back to what was solid in myself, well, I just slowly and laboriously begin picking up the playing cards again and laying them edge to edge and one on top of the other. And I would reconstruct myself as a Buddhist. But then maybe a year or two later, another inner storm would just blow down the aces and the queens, the clubs and the diamonds, blow them in all directions. And this time, when I saw what was left, I found that I believed in awareness. I believed that awareness was always a good thing. And I believed in, well, we could call it metta. I didn't mind. And I believed that everything was conditioned, was impermanent. So, this process repeated itself several times over the years. And after a while, my attitude to it changed. When it first used to happen, I used to feel bewildered and distraught. My faith in Buddhism seemed to be coming apart. And I hastened to put it all back together as soon as possible. But after a few years, I almost used to invite these crises. And in a way, doing so showed that my confidence in the whole process of myself as a practitioner of the Dharma had grown. To start with, I just needed some security and certainty in my life. And I gained it from my belief in Buddhism. But later, what was really most crucial for me was to find out the truth. And if that meant living in an uncertain universe, even living without Buddhism, well, so be it. In my earlier practice, I treated the Dharma reverently, like some very beautiful but rather fragile crystal vase. Later, wanting only the truth, I picked up my Dharma vase and began trying to smash it. I beat at it with the hammer of reason, reasoned argument. I scratched it with the diamond of my own experience. And when it emerged from these tests, unscathed and as beautiful as ever, I at last felt true reverence for it. And having been prepared to risk everything, I found a lot more certainty. I began to become convinced that my Dharma vase was actually made of Vajra. So this is our first crucial situation. I don't know if it's true, but reading accounts of traditional Buddhism in the East, it often appears, at least, that they find it relatively easy to take the Dharma and their teachers on trust, on faith, and just get on with their practice. But Westerners may well find that part of the Buddhist path may involve periodically asking ourselves whether we're a Buddhist. Obviously, you don't want to do this too much. Otherwise, you're a bit like, well, Bante sometimes uses the example of a gardener who keeps pulling up a plant to look at the roots to see that it's growing well. But if we find it happening from time to time, well, I don't think we should feel bad or disloyal, but simply take it that we're being given an opportunity to search more deeply and intensely for the truth. Doing that is good Buddhist practice. For our second crucial situation, I want to consider the case of, well, probably still quite a young knight, but he's of the Round Table. He was dubbed a knight, well, quite a few years ago now. And he was very proud to join the fellowship of the Round Table. And he started out on the Grail Quest, brimming with enthusiasm. Every day he practices swordsmanship and anti-dragon manoeuvres. And every day he prays to be granted a vision of the Grail. He also faithfully attends all the gatherings of the knights at Camelot at Christmas, Easter, and so on. And he's rather surprised to find that not all knights do the same. Of course, some are lost on the quest, and some are recovering from wounds. But he can't help noticing that there are others who are actually staying quite close to Camelot, who, it seems, cannot be bothered to attend. And he does feel slightly haughty and superior to them. Now, occasionally, in his early days as a young knight, he does have times when he loses his sense of himself and his mission, but he comes through those difficulties very well. However, after a few years of adventuring, and even making a bit of a name for himself as a model knight, something very strange happens. It almost seems to happen overnight. He's been single-mindedly adventuring, focused only on the Grail Quest. In fact, to be honest, he's tended to rather look down on the common people with whom his mission brings him into contact. Now, all of a sudden, as if a trapdoor has opened under his feet, he's precipitated into a whole range of emotions that he's hardly known before. Indeed, all of a sudden, he's much more emotional in general. He finds himself laughing and crying easily. He feels much more empathy for other human beings that he meets. Indeed, he starts to wonder if dragons have feelings too. And he feels rather uneasy about trying to rid the country of them. Before he started on the quest, our knight used to love music, probably with a K on the end in those days. But he'd given all that up as a distraction when he became a knight. But now he finds himself, without quite meaning to, wiping the dust off his lute and beginning to play it. Tentatively, he starts playing and singing some of the love songs that he wrote when he was younger, when he was still a squire. And sometimes, too, he goes off dancing at the village festivals. And he feels very confused, for none of these things have any obvious connection with the quest for the Grail. Yet he feels suddenly much more human, more open-hearted, more himself. And from this new emotional perspective, the person that he was up until very recently, the knight who prayed and fasted, who was obsessive about sword practice, and who never missed a meeting at Camelot, seems a rigid, narrow, and unappealing character. His quest seems too driven, too goal-oriented. At times, he now realizes he's been quite cold. He's been leaving out his heart, his humanity. His heart and his humanity beckon to him. In fact, they're beckoning to him very strongly, personified in the form of a young country girl who he darts with. I'm not telling you which of these bits come from my experience, which is my observation. The young country girl who he danced with at a harvest festival a few days ago. Before he became a knight, he'd always been rather shy and unconfident around people to whom he was attracted. But being dubbed a knight and having all those adventures and so on have given him a newfound confidence. So he begins to think, well, why shouldn't he settle down in the village? The villagers need a knight on hand to deal with the bandits who come by from time to time and the occasional foraging dragon. He could still spend a week or two here and there doing some questing for the Grail. Our young knight feels torn. Part of him feels that what has happened to him has been a breakthrough. He feels more alive than ever before. Yet he also feels a guilty awareness that he pledged allegiance to his king and to finding the Grail. Although he hasn't given up the quest and believes that living in the village he can still practice knight-errantry, well, in his heart of hearts he has a not very examined sense of guilt that he's somehow compromised himself. He's lost the purity of his previous questing. But the thought of going back to how he was before, who he was before, fills him with a kind of dread. From his current perspective, even if he could give up the local beauty in the village, his previous approach to things now seems alien. To go back to it feels as if he'd be putting on a straitjacket. So he doesn't go back. And this leaves him with a sense of unresolved unease. And that makes him very sensitive. He becomes concerned that other members of the round table may start to look down on him. They may say that he's given up the quest. He starts to find it painful going to Camelot, being amongst his brothers in arms and hearing them describing their adventures. And even though the king and other older knights always seem pleased to see him and ask after him, somehow he feels that he is not a proper knight. And the speeches, the words of counsel and advice that the king gives to those on the quest, and the speeches and counsel of the other senior knights that our knights used to find so inspiring, somehow no longer move him in the same way. The account that they give of the Grail quest seems somehow too idealistic and unrealistic. The words don't seem to be speaking to him. So our knight visits Camelot less and less. He keeps up some contact with a few brother knights who are old friends, and he does a bit of questing now and then. And at times, on winter nights, when he cannot sleep, he has visions of a seat at the round table in Camelot, an empty seat with his name written above it, a seat that is being faithfully kept for him. This is our second crucial situation. And although it's very hard to generalize about these things, aspects of it do seem to be quite common on the men's side of the order. But in the West, sorry for any Indian Dharmacharis present, I'm not sure how much of this speaks to you, but you will at least perhaps learn more about some of your Western brothers, or at least about me. What typically happens is that someone has been a good Buddhist. They've meditated regularly, practiced right livelihood, either inside or outside FWBO structures. If they're an order member, they've regularly attended their chapter and order events. Then, at a certain point, something happens. As I described the case of the young knight, it's as if a trapdoor opens under them, and they're precipitated into a whole range of emotions that they've never experienced so strongly before. They begin to question the whole way in which they're living their life. And they start feeling free. With all these new emotions, they start feeling much freer than they've done before. And that freedom is also the freedom not to meditate, not to attend a chapter or order events, and so forth. And often they begin reviving interests or friendships that they had before they became a Buddhist, which they may for a while have discarded as not very spiritual. Now, I don't know how quite to describe or to characterize this phenomenon, but I do see it quite a lot in Shabda and elsewhere. I suppose I tend to think of it as a kind of falling out of the head and into the heart center. And that naturally does feel very good. And it does represent spiritual progress. One becomes much closer to a whole range of emotions. One experiences more of oneself, more of one's humanity. And that is a great gain. But there is often a problem, as we saw with our young knight, who ended up in not really an ideal situation. This does frequently seem to happen quite fast, quite suddenly. And because of that, there's quite a sense of discontinuity between the old self and the new. The new, more feeling self often has a bit of a sense of revulsion at the earlier version. As I said, the old self is now often dismissed as a bit narrow and cold and willed and naively idealistic and not very individual. And there is, of course, some truth in this assessment. However, there are dangers here. This crisis is a breakthrough and can be very productive and fruitful. However, if its meaning is misunderstood and mishandled, you can end up in a bit of a spiritual cul-de-sac. The danger is that in leaving behind the old, narrow self, one also leaves behind everything associated with it. One doesn't just leave behind how one was. One also feels like leaving behind everything associated with that narrow, less individual self. In his willed, slightly mechanical, less individual way, the old self practiced meditation every day and always attended order events and so forth. And these activities all become associated with the old self from which one is trying to break free. But the danger, of course, is of throwing out the baby with the good old cliched bathwater. After all, how did this breakthrough into the heart happen? Lots of people go through their entire lives a bit cold and a bit mechanical and not terribly individual. Like everything else, this breakthrough into the heart arose in dependence upon conditions. It was brought about by the practices that one was doing before. Presumably, all that dutiful meditation and attending order weekends and so forth provided the conditions for a new, more human and feeling person to emerge. Although it may have been a bit rigid and mechanical, all that meditation and slightly forced spiritual friendship had the effect of gradually developing deeper awareness, of moving awareness from the head centre to the heart centre. It enabled the breakthrough to happen, and it shouldn't be dismissed. For many years now, I've tended in my own practice to use Western alchemical images of spiritual life from time to time. For me, the discipline of meditation, study, ethics, attending chapter meetings, and so forth, is like an alchemical cauldron in which the enemy, in which the energy of one's emotional life is transformed. These disciplines, they all provide a container. They keep your energy focused so that an alchemical reaction can take place. Now, in the early stages of spiritual alchemy, we don't know ourselves terribly well. So we apply spiritual methods in a rather mechanical way. You know, we just sort of turn up the heat, sort of any old how. And if our cauldron is rather small and rather rigid, which it usually is to start with, sooner or later there's an explosion. The rigid cauldron cracks and pieces fly in all directions and energy pours out. And this resultant release of energy is liberating, well, or frightening, depending on how much understanding you have of what is actually happening. So how should we try to work in this crucial situation if we find ourselves, or one of our friends, falling into the heart centre in this way? Well, firstly, we shouldn't panic in the middle of this, or what can feel like a meltdown, sort of psycho-spiritual meltdown. We should take an interest in the process, in those new feelings that are appearing, in what is coming into consciousness. To start with, very often, if this happens to you, at least in an extreme way, you may find that you won't be able to do very much formal meditation. It may be enough you may just need to sit and witness, to experience what you are turning into. Because what's so difficult about spiritual life is that you don't just, you as you, sit in the middle, kind of making things change. You as subject change. And that is deeply sort of disturbing at times. You don't know quite what's going on. You knew who you were, and suddenly you're not that, and you're transforming into you know not what. And that is, that's why spiritual life is so challenging. So you may just need to sit and witness what is happening. Also, you may feel quite sensitive for a while. You may have a whole lot of sort of new feeling that you're in touch with. And you may find it difficult to be on a National Order weekend with 210 people, for instance. So for a little while, it may be enough just to keep in good touch with your chapter or just one or two good friends who can help the process along. But after a while, we need to go back and rebuild the alchemical cauldron. It needs to be a much bigger, a much more flexible cauldron with more sensitive heat controls. But if the energy of our previous breakthrough isn't just going to leak away gradually, we need to re-engage with those formal practices which focus our energy more and more. We need to recognise that there was nothing wrong with the methods. Indeed, they brought us to this point. It's the way that we were using them that needs to change. We need to make them our own. We need to use them sensitively, with real awareness of who we are, moment by moment. We also need to bring all of ourselves into our Dharma life. We may need to come to chapter meetings and order gatherings open-hearted, with all the messy imperfections and complexities of our humanity, and to communicate that in the light of the Dharma. Indeed, this seems to be, in a way, the key to dealing with this crucial situation. We need to find ways of healing the split, which seems so common in the West, between the real and the ideal. It seems very hard for us to hold the two together, fully acknowledging our ideals and also where we are actually at. This is a difficulty which may have something to do with traditional Christianity, but thankfully I have no time to try and unpack that. In the early stages of the spiritual life, we tend more to idealism. In rational terms, as we've seen, this can mean taking on views and not testing them very fully. In emotional terms, it involves narrowing down our interests and often, in a way, pushing aside certain aspects of ourselves that don't fit with our Buddhist life. But then at a certain point, we widen out again emotionally. Our heart opens. But we often feel thrown, as if we've lost something of our previous pure idealistic approach to the Dharma. So we need to bring all of ourselves into the light of our ideals, hold those two together, even though there seems such a gulf, such a disparity between the two. If we do that, then we shall begin to heal the split between our idealism and our consciousness of our everyday human reality. I find it interesting how many great Western mythic stories contain an idealistic, striving hero who finds himself accompanied on some great adventure by a much more down-to-earth, everyday sort of character. The down-to-earth figure often doesn't really want to be on the adventure at all, and is only there through seeming chance or just out of devotion to his much more idealistic master. Yet it often turns out that the down-to-earth character is in some way essential to the success of the adventure. Often he's gone searching for food and drink, or running away from the dragon, and finds something lucky, something valuable for the quest. There are lots of examples of these in Western literature. In Spanish you have Don Quixote, idealistic knight, and his servant Sancho Panza. Or in Mozart's Magic Flute, you have Tamino, a knight who begins Act One by fighting or trying to fight a dragon. And he's accompanied on his adventure by Papageno, who's a bird catcher, who just wants to settle down with a pretty little wife. but they find themselves going through the adventure together. Or I suppose to take the most popular immediate example, you have hobbits. The folk from the Shire who love eating and feasting. And they form an essential part of Tolkien's Fellowship of the Ring, along with noble characters like the wizard Gandalf and the princely Aragorn. Indeed, it's a hobbit who has to be the bearer of the One Ring. So there's some psycho-spiritual truth for us here. We have to bring together our idealistic sides and the depths of our humanity. Spiritual life doesn't involve jettisoning our humanity, but transforming it in the light of the Dharma. There's an awful lot more I could say about all this, but I'd like to just look a little more at one more crucial situation. Now, in this last crucial situation, well, before we've seen relatively young knights, or new knights, let's say, they may not be that young, but some members of the Fellowship of the Round Table have been adventuring for years, many years. Well, let's just follow one knight. He's well into middle age. He's ventured far in his quest, over many lands, fighting many battles on the way. But there's still no sign of the Grail. And his noble steed is getting rather old and lame. And the knight's reflexes are getting a bit slow for fighting dragons. And his arthritic right knee sometimes gives way as he's rescuing a maiden from a tower. And at times, he worries about the future. How will he support himself when he's too old for adventuring? I mean, look at him now in his old ragged cloak. It's only really his knightly ideals that distinguish him from some of the vagabonds riding the pathways of England. So what will become of him? If success in the Grail quest depends upon purity of mind, well, he knows that his mental states are a mixed bag. There are some positive habits that he's established very well now over many years. But there are also some negative tendencies that he somehow never quite got around to working on. He was meant to, but he just didn't quite manage to. And these two have become quite deep ruts. And while in the early stages of the quest he could see changes in himself, well, almost every week, now he struggles to make progress, like an army fighting uphill against an enemy that's well dug in. Every yard, certainly against these negative tendencies, has to be gained by intense effort. And he lives in a world that's changed greatly since he was part of that early handful of knights who set out to quest together, believing that it would only be a few months, well, a year or two at most, before they were all living permanently in the presence of the Grail. And when he started out, there seemed to be a whole movement in society, young people full of idealism for a new world. Now, well, the knights are hardly respected. People are only interested in improving their material lot. As he rides slowly along on his old mount, he passes long queues of farm wagons on the roads as peasants go off to buy new reeds for their floors, new logs, seats, and sticks to patch up their dwellings. Don't know where they get them from, Do It All or Hobble Base. Ha ha ha. And when he returns to Camelot, although he's really glad to see old friends, it has to be admitted he's a little bit tired sometimes by some of the young knights. They're full of this gung-ho energy for the Grail quest. He finds it quite hard to relate to them anymore. So what is he to do? Should he push on, continuing to follow the quest to which he's given the best years of his life? Or should he start looking to the future? Perhaps he should give up questing and do something that will ensure that he'll be provided for in his old age. Now, one can easily sympathise with the ageing knight's plight. Well, I can certainly sympathise with the ageing knight's plight. Middle age brings another shower of reality which can easily douse whatever's left of the idealism of youth. And some of that reality has sort of doused the idealism of youth, of the early movement in some ways. In the early days of the order, there was quite a sense that the spiritual war would be all over by Christmas. The FWBO would make a major impact on the world. And we were part of a wider movement in society. An alternative radical culture. In the late 60s and early 70s, it did seem possible that there could be a major social revolution. Nowadays, for better or worse, consumerism and capitalism are dominant. So in a way, there's sort of less emotional support to be drawn on. And economically, way back then, there were full student grants for those who wanted to go to college, and it was easy to sign on as unemployed and receive a basic amount of support. So economically, times are tougher, and there's an increasing awareness that those of us who haven't provided financially for their old age may be left with very little. So one can understand people who feel the need, or even see it as their responsibility, to provide for themselves as they grow older, even if it means that they perhaps have less time and energy to put into direct Dharma work and Dharma practice. And each person has to make their own decision in the light of this. Personally, though, I made a decision about this a long time ago, and I see no real reason to change it. I decided that basically there were two possibilities for my old age. If I lived that long, and all of us only have this moment now, of which we can be certain. Either by the time I was old, I would have got somewhere with the Dharma, in which case it wouldn't bother me terribly much if I was starving in a garret somewhere. Or I would not have got somewhere with the Dharma, in which case the fact that I was starving in a garret somewhere would only add insult to the real injury. My sense of whether my life is worthwhile or not depends on the Dharma. And somehow or other, I have always believed that the Dharma protects those who practice it. There's a Tibetan Lama, I'm not sure if it's Gungtang Rinpoche, Pabongka Rinpoche, who once claimed that no sincere Dharma practitioner had ever starved. And I can't actually think of a case that disproves his statement. So personally, I would like to see lots of us sort of going for broke, putting the Dharma first, second, and third in our lives. Yes, as a result, some of us might end up having to live at a subsistence level. We may not be able to afford the best health care or to travel as much as we'd like, but we're very unlikely to starve in the West. Indeed, we're very likely to live in conditions that most serious Buddhist practitioners down the centuries would have thought were pretty comfortable, really. And also, comfortable conditions aren't always the most helpful. I spent most of my recent sabbatical year in a wooden hut in the Spanish mountains, in Artadashin's hut. I had his ashes in a corner of the hut. And I have to say that my life and my Dharma practice were very much easier under those conditions than they now are, now that I've come back to a nice little flat in Birmingham. So it may be that our knight will find a way of providing for himself that enables him to continue with his quest, perhaps even to help others to continue on their quest, in which case that's fine. But to the extent that our knight is thinking of compromising his quest, of playing safe, I must say that I really hope he finds the courage to carry on. And if he's going to do that, it seems to me, well, he's going to have to produce, well, quite a lot of sort of insight into reality for a sort of Christian knight. All sorts of conditions lead up to all kinds of midlife crises, but often they're at least partly brought on by intimations that life will leave us with nothing. As we get older, and bits start to fall apart and drop off, we start to be able to picture ourselves sitting in the ruins of our health, our vitality, our virility, dare I say. And in response, we can start looking for comfort. And also, often, along with that, we're at a stage in our spiritual lives where we're out there in the deep water. We're struggling with our really deep, intractable habits, sanskaras that we may have had for who knows how many lifetimes. So the tendency can be to get discouraged, to head for cover, to settle for comfort. In his old cloak on his aging steed, surrounded by people busy feathering their nests, it would be easy for our knight to feel that if he carries on with the quest, that he will be left with nothing, surrounded by all these people who've got their log seats and their reed floors. But hopefully he'll realise that it's worldly life that will always leave him with nothing. Even if he stops his questing and starts providing for his old age will gradually strip him of all ordinary happiness. And at death, he'll have to leave behind his possessions, his family, his friends, his loved ones. So actually, it's mundane life that's guaranteed to leave him with nothing sooner or later. The only thing that he'll take with him into old age and death is whatever he has made of himself. If he's had a vision of the Grail, then he won't care if he's dying in a lonely cave. So yeah, we need to make provision for old age. We may need to make financial provision, but essentially we need to make provision that is spiritual. It needs to be faith, metta, and insight stored in our hearts. So that was our third crucial situation. I'm well aware, in a way, of some of the limitations of this talk. I've had to make some very large generalizations about Westerners and the spiritual life. And there may be some of you for whom nothing of what I said applies, because your cultural conditioning is different, or because you're a different kind of character, or because you have a lot of faith and good karma. So I apologize if you don't quite see the point. I would have liked something more obviously inspiring than a talk about spiritual difficulties and crises. However, even if you feel that none of this applies to you, I suggest that you file it away. Either so that you can help other order members or mitras who are going through the kinds of difficulties I've described, or just one day, well, who knows. And personally, I do find considering these topics inspiring. Bhante, in a poem, refers to spiritual life as not being like a broad highway, but more like hacking a rough path through the jungle. And I believe that this is especially true for us as an early generation of Western Buddhists. Our maps and charts of the spiritual life are only rough and approximate. We're still learning what the spiritual life is like for Westerners. So I'd like us to be working to improve our maps. And this can partly be done by continuing to explore the Eastern heritage, coming to know the tradition better. But also, I'd like to see us continuing Bante's work of exploring our Western heritage, including perhaps Western religious literature. It can be easy to think that because we have the Dharma, we shall never experience a dark night of the soul, or aksidhi, which is a kind of spiritual sloth, discouragement, indifference, depression, common to monks living ascetic lives in the Middle Ages. But we're a sort of crossbreed generation. Yes, we have the Dharma, and it's been very ably translated for us by Bante. But we also have psyches that are deeply influenced by Western culture and tradition. Those of us who are born in Western culture and tradition. So we can perhaps expect our spiritual lives to be a mixture, showing aspects of both the Dharma and Western conditioning. So we need to make new maps as a result of that mixture of influences. So if we're to make new maps, it's also important that we share with one another what we learn on the spiritual life. And not just when we're inspired, good as that is, even if we're having difficulties and problems, rather than sort of skulking off, you know, to lick our wounds, it's important that we share those with other people. Because they're all parts of the map. It may be that they're dead ends and we can save other order members from going down them, but it also may be sometimes that these things are valuable, or even that they're breakthroughs, but we haven't fully realised it. So, I hope that as order members we can work together to make more and more accurate maps of the spiritual life as it's lived out in practice by us. And I hope that we can include in those maps all kinds of crucial situations, including those that I've outlined. The crisis of belief, falling into the heart centre, in which we can find our ideals and our humanity, to start with at least, in conflict, unless we bring them together. And all the various kinds of crises that can come upon us in middle age, when we have to begin to work out a strategy for how we shall play the end game of our spiritual lives. Now, I've probably said enough, and my time must be about up. But in preparing this talk, I did find a rather odd and eccentric postscript to it coming to my mind. And it insisted that it was part of the talk, although it seems a very odd note to end on. And my first instinct was to leave it on the cutting room floor. But as this part of my consciousness was very insistent, I'm going to tell you what it wanted to say, and you can make whatever you will of it. It was this. And at the end of the quest, you ride up at last to the Grail Castle. Its moat is full, its drawbridge raised. So you blow a note on your horn, and after some time a face appears at an upper window of a tower. As the face is hidden in shadow, you can't tell if it's old or young, male or female. But from it a voice calls out, "We're closed for repairs. Come back for our grand reopening on April the 1st. The tea rooms are open though, and you can view the grounds. You'll need to buy a ticket from the kiosk. Yeah? It's next to Sir Galahad's gift shop." "But I've come for the Grail," you cry. "Oh, that," says the voice. "You'll have to go around the back." And the face vanishes. As the face has disappeared, and the drawbridge is still raised, and the moat is still as full as it was 5 minutes ago, there's no alternative. you ride round the back. Behind the castle is the kitchen garden. There's just cabbages and radishes and a large wooden shed. It looks like it should be full of tools. The sort of place where the gardeners might make their tea. There's nobody around. So you dismount and go to explore the shed. Inside it, you find someone you recognise. An old man. An old retainer from Camelot, who used to be a servant of your family when you first set out on the quest. "What are you doing here?" you ask. "I've been working here for years," he replies. "Climate's better for my joints than Camelot, and I prefer a quieter life. There's always too much going on at Arthur's Court. But once they open this theme park here next spring, I'll be thinking of moving on again. What brings you here?" "I'm questing for the Grail. I believe it's here somewhere." "Oh, that. Well, if you came on horseback, it's here now, though it wouldn't before." "What do you mean?" "Well, all those years ago, when you suddenly got fired up with this knight-errantry business and wanted to leave in a tearing hurry, I was told to saddle your horse. You were in too much of a rush, babbling on about the quest and being a perfect knight, for me to find out what you was questing for. But I thought the Grail might come in useful for you. So I slipped it in the bottom of your left-hand saddlebag. Under that copy of Konza's translation of the Large Sutra of Perfect Wisdom that you wanted to take along." "Oh, that. I never got around to reading it." "Oh, I might have known that you probably wouldn't. So are you trying to tell me that I've been riding around the country all these years, starving, fighting battles, being nearly baked alive by dragons, and all the time the Grail was within 6 inches of my left leg?" "That's right." "So all that questing was a complete and utter waste of time?" "No, I wouldn't say that. If you hadn't spent all those years searching, you wouldn't have ridden round the back of the Grail Castle this afternoon. You wouldn't have met me. And I wouldn't have told you where to find the Grail. Anyway, take a look in that saddlebag. It should be there right enough." "But how did you come to have the Grail in the first place?" "Well, that's a long story. There's no time for it now. I've got to get back to my garden." And with that, he wanders outside into the cabbages. So that's the postscript. This talk has been a long story, and there's very much more that I could have said. But there's no time for it now. I've got to get back to my garden.